I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, a father uses boundless love, ferocious African-American pride, and sometimes his fists to keep his son from being an inner-city statistic. But first, the National Weather Service is predicting crests of 10 feet and more above flood stage along the Mississippi River, with more rain on the way. In Minnesota, the governor has declared a state emergency in two counties. Wisconsin Governor Jim Doyle said he would ask for a federal disaster declaration for parts of his state. And in Iowa, towns have been shoring up levees with sandbags to prevent swollen rivers from flooding. The city of Waterloo has shut its downtown and closed some major bridges. In Palo, Iowa, city officials have told residents to evacuate, predicting flood levels 2 feet higher than in 1993, when most of the state was left underwater. Upriver is Cedar Falls. Susan Stout is the public information officer there. And Susan, what's your concern there? What's going on in Cedar Falls?
Well, the river crested at an all-time high of 102.13 feet as of 1 o'clock this morning. Our levee is 102 feet, so obviously we've surpassed the levee height. The water is right up to the top of the levee at this time.
Yeah. So what are you doing?
As of yesterday, we had thousands of volunteers come to sandbag, and then they're placing the sandbags on top of the levee. And in certain areas, they're reinforcing the levee so that it doesn't bow out. The mayor evacuated the downtown area as of 2 o'clock yesterday afternoon. And we emphasized that our efforts needed to be directed to the levee, and not protecting businesses by sandbagging individual businesses downtown. We wanted all the sandbagging efforts to be done at the levee. I'm really proud to be from Cedar Falls because the thousands of volunteers is quite a sight to see.
Is it working?
It's working so far. Unfortunately, we've got ominous weather coming from the west.
Yeah.
We hope for the best and plan for the worst. If the levee breaks, a good portion of downtown is going to be flooded,
now we
including
know,
our sewage treatment plant, which would be devastating.
Give us a sense of what it's like on those sandbag lines.
People's spirits are pretty high because we're defeating Mother Nature at this point in time. It's just amazing how hard people are working. We're not out of the woods yet, so we've asked for volunteers to come today. We can't have enough, quite frankly.
Yeah. We're reading the wire reports, and in some other towns, for instance, are giving, 15 sandbags out per home, so that people can defend their homes. Are you worried about running out of sandbags?
Not at this time. We've gotten tremendous supplies and support from other areas, even out of the state, by delivering sandbags and sand.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about Cedar Falls and what happens in that downtown and, what this might mean.
Well, downtown Cedar Falls is a historic site. It's very quaint and it's a parkade area. It's got a lot of nice businesses. It would be devastating if downtown is lost.
Well, I'm wondering, Susan, as we let you go to do your work, you must have watched the pictures we all watched yesterday in Wisconsin as the Lake Delton there just literally broke and homes swept away. I'm just wondering how chilling that was for you to see what was going on in Wisconsin.
Yeah, it just makes me sick.
Yeah.
I don't know what to say. Unfortunately, we have a lot of company and how devastated we are.
That's Susan Stout. She's the public information officer for Cedar Falls, Iowa. They are sandbagging like crazy. 500,000 sandbags put up yesterday with thousands of volunteers helping. Susan, best of luck to you.
Thank you.
Well, just in time for Father's Day this Sunday, a new memoir tells of growing up in inner city Baltimore in the 80s and 90s. With a father for a ferocious protector.
When I was young, my father was heroic to me, was all that I knew of religion. His word was the difference between pancakes and oatmeal, between speed racer and yard work. Every trip to the food barn was epic. We'd hop out the car and I'd try to shut the door in rhythm with them, like on detective shows when they meant business. There were days when I would have wished him into nothing so that I could be free to relish in the dumb stuff with all the other laughing orphan boys. There were others when I looked around and saw that, though the birthright of every child was a manned fortress, we lived in unnatural times. All the guardians had fled their posts, and here was mine, his hand on his sword, his armor glimmering in the light of moons.
Ta-Nehisi Coates' new memoir is The Beautiful Struggle, a father, two sons, and an unlikely road to manhood. It tells of how his father and mother tried to keep him from being a statistic. Now, Baltimore is the second most dangerous city in America, according to a 2007 FBI report. This year, there were 85 murders in the city. A school consultant said there was a greater chance that young men in Baltimore will die violently than there was for soldiers in Vietnam. And the high school dropout rate is somewhere between 40 and 60%. Ta-Nehisi Coates came from this. He's a former staff writer for The Village Voice and Time magazine, and he joins us. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And what a glorious read. It's the story of fathers and sons, but a poem, too. It's sort of like an African-American howl.
Yes, that's what I was going for.
Really?
I love howl. Howl was extremely, extremely influential in the Negro streets searching for jazz. I'll always remember that line. Very influential on me.
Well, also, watching the best minds of your generation.
That's
you
right.
Know?
Yes, exactly.
That's what your life was like. And there was your father, you know, guardian, whether or not you liked it, and normally you didn't. Let's start with your father, Paul Coates. Who is he?
My father was a young man who grew up in North and West Philadelphia, impoverished, who went off to Vietnam, became disenchanted with the war, joined the Black Panther Party, began his long career as a father, ended it with 7 children by 4 women. And I always say, you know, as I say in the book, on paper, that really looks like a mess. But my father was very much of the cult of fatherhood. And the book takes place during a time when a lot of Black men, a lot of brothers in our community weren't members of that cult. And my father was one of the just a huge, huge adherents. And so it's about that relationship. The book is between me, my older brother, Big Bill, and my father.
Right. Your dad, as you said, he split from the Black Panthers.
Yes, he did.
But part of the legacy of the Black Panthers is a sense of free love,
yes.
which he adopted freely.
Yes, he did.
But,
yes,
but he also was incredibly strict. He gave you beatings, but it seemed like what he was afraid.
He was tremendously afraid. And I guess the reason why it's hard for me to think, and especially, you know, when it pertains to the beatings, the reason why it's very hard for me to think of that is strict is because it was of the time. I mean, this is going to sound weird. I know, you know, mores change and how we deal with children change. But at that point in time, anybody whose child was cared about by anyone who I knew was spanked. I mean, that was just the way it was. And it actually presented quite a quandary when I started writing the book, because I did not want my dad to come off as this sort of abusive figure. And at the same time, I felt that you couldn't understand, you know, who he was as a father. You couldn't understand my relationship to him if you did not understand that a huge part of my relationship with him revolved around fear. And that fear was mirrored, you know, in a much larger sense by the fear that he held for us.
Right. In one instance, he really roughs you up after you do something stupid, and he says to your mom, "Who do you want doing this, me or the cops?" And you write that in that moment, you understand you could be shot by police for making a stupid, misunderstood move. And then there were, of course, the gangs and, the streets. And, you know, you say you were made to understand as a child that as a Black child in that neighborhood, your time was short. And this was the message that your parents delivered to you. So there was a belt buckle, and there were sometimes, you know, fists. He let it fly. But he also saved your life. I mean, when you and your brother were attacked by a gang, you called your dad.
Mm-hmm. What I always remember is after he came, sitting in the back seat, my mom in the front seat, and looking out the window and watching him. And there were just kids everywhere. I mean, just kids everywhere, watching him just go through these kids to try to find, you know, my older brother who was still, you know, amongst them and in trouble. And he was just completely fearless.
He started his own press publishing company in the basement to print out works of African Americans. And you say he was conscious. You use that word a lot through the book. What does it mean to you?
One of the things that you have to know about me going into this book is I was introduced to language in a very organic way. And that is, you know, through, I guess, a spoken word. I hate that term. It has such a bad connotation now. But what I'm trying to tell you is I was introduced to the beauty of language through popular things, playing Dungeons and Dragons and listening to hip hop. And I came to more of the sort of classical things, you know, F. Scott Fitzgerald, that sort of thing, much, much later. So I've always had a deep appreciation for the sort of organic ways that people play with language. And one of the more beautiful things that, you know, folks in my father's community would say was that if you, you know, knew who you were as an African American, if you were fully aware of your history, you were quote unquote conscious. And I just thought it was such a subtle way and beautiful way, at the same time overstated way, of basically saying, you know, I read the autobiography of Malcolm X. It really changed my life. Everything I read is about Black people. I'm completely obsessed with Black people. I just thought, I mean, you just say you're conscious. It was such a classy way of saying that. And I thought it was such a beautiful word. I had to fit it in.
Well, meantime, you came to it late, though, yourself. I mean, you're obviously, as we read the book, an incredible writer, and yet you were flunking out. You're hearing that as a young man, you have a good chance of dying. Your parents are in a community that's conscious. What are you doing in your head? Why are you rejecting that?
What I'm doing in my head is the same thing I'm doing in my head today, which is being in my own head and not paying attention to the world around me. I mean, in the book and, you know, in my life, I got a lot better, you know, but at the same time, I think that shielded me, because it was only later. In fact, it was only after I got to college that I could fully assess what had actually happened and where I had, you know, how I had come up. And I have to stress that I had so much more than so many other kids who I was friends with, who I went to school with. I had two parents. I never worried about food to eat. I never worried about clothes on my back. So in many ways, my sort of airheadedness, my sort of, you know, lack of consciousness, my sort of lack of knowledge was a luxury afforded by my parents and afforded by so many people who basically watched my back.
You're right, there was another shift for you when music went from the corporate sound of Whitney Houston, which you just couldn't relate to Chuck D, Public Enemy. Tell us more about those influences.
Oh, man. I mean, hip-hop taught me to love language and taught me how to think about the world. And, I mean, these folks taught me how to love language, and they taught me how to write, because hip-hop at its best, you know, functions much like a sonnet. It's just words condensed, and you're trying to make them as powerful as you can. And that was my first introduction to one of the core values of writing and what you're trying to do when you write. You know, be very economic with your words. You know, make them, you know, do as much work as you possibly can. I desperately wanted that to happen with this book. This book is pretty much a love song. When the reader read it, I wanted them to feel the rhythm of it, much as, you know, you feel the rhythm of a great hip-hop song. That's only one capable breaks the unbreakable melodies, unmakeable pattern, unescapable a horn. If you want the style of a I bless the child, the earth, the gods, and bomb the rest of those in NBA. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. There existed a Baltimore where school is for school's sakes, where kids' greatest worries were spelling tests and the first awkward juvenile crush. But in Mundarmin, the vultures among us corrupted everything. They were not growing into something better. They were not finding their deeper selves. The knowledge was a disease. Some took to it faster than others, but eventually we all got it. We all grew tired of getting touched. We were just like boys everywhere, dreaming of model trains, Captain Marvel, and chemistry sets. But for us, there were orcs outside the door, blood in their teeth, and always waiting. At some point, we grew tired of crumbling under their boots and embraced the knowledge, became like all the rest, groping for manhood in the dark.
That's Ta-Nehisi Coates reading from his new memoir, The Beautiful Struggle, his story of growing up Black in inner-city Baltimore, his fiercely protective father standing between him and guns, drugs, and violence. The book is also about his brother, Big Bill, who made it out of Baltimore to Howard University in D.C. It was Mecca to the Coates family. But Bill brought his West Baltimore mindset with him to college, selling marijuana. At one point, he and his friends got into a confrontation with a college kid they thought was fooling around with one of their girlfriends, and it ended with Bill pulling a gun, shooting it in the air. No one was hurt, but Ta-Nehisi, this could have been a disaster.
It could have been a complete disaster.
Yeah.
There before the grace of God go I. I mean, there's so many moments in the book where people just get lucky, and it could have... It just could have went totally another way. It really, really could have. And I think at the same time, that was an epiphany for him, you know. And I think, you know, sitting back and contemplating how much he could have lost over something so stupid as some guy's girlfriend who turned out not to be his girlfriend.
He was just saying it.
Was a really bracing reality. And I'm going to tell you, the prisons are filled with people in the exact sort of situations where it was just something stupid. I mean, just the dumbest things you ever want to imagine. I mean, it drives, I think I can speak collectively for Black folks, it drives us crazy. It really does.
Part of what seemed to motivate your dad is keeping his kids alive, which is so powerful.
That's right.
But you discover that your dad, who, as we said, you know, was this heroic character, had his flaws, had a big one. Yeah.
He did. He had a huge one, and we won't say what that was, but suffice to say, I have great, great respect and admiration for my dad, despite flaws. One thing I told my dad when we were going through this is I would strip him naked and put him up against all of his flaws, all of his qualities, against any human being on earth. I really, really believe that. And that was what I think gave me what I needed to reveal so much, to be so naked in the writing, because I believe that we all have flaws and no one's clean. No one's clean. And I think that's the humanity that I hope rings with people. I think that, if anything pulls folks into the book, it's going to be that. I didn't want to do a whitewash job.
Well, and when you see, you know, his determined fathering, you stand up and applaud. Especially, you write the book as, you know, we hear the statistics. The percentage of black children living in fatherless homes is about 50%.
Yes.
And, you know, we have someone, a black man running for president whose father essentially left his family too.
That's right.
What do you say to that statistic, absent black fathers?
I say that that's probably the most troubling statistic to me personally, because I think it's very hard for two people to raise kids isolated outside of a society without a supportive community. Because one of the things I tried to get across was that it was not just my father and my mother, who I must mention, but that it was the people that they surrounded me with, the larger community. I don't care how corny it sounds. It really does take a village. Childhood is such a difficult thing, because I know for at least the first 20 years of my life, I was out of my mind and I needed people to keep me, you know, from doing something stupid. What I would hope that people would take from the books is through it all, through all of that, there isn't a single black boy out there, no matter what stat you hit, there's not a single black boy out there who thinks it's cool that he's failing. Not a single black boy out there who thinks it's cool to be dumb. It's not a single black boy out there who's glad to be, you know, shipped off to prison. You know, black folks and black boys want the same things that everybody else wants. But there are so many things within the environment that turn you onto paths that you really shouldn't be on. So many places where you could just take a turn for the worse. It just takes so little. It's such a, you know, these little small decisions. And I think when you don't have people there who are guiding you, the likelihood that you're going to make one of those bad decisions just increases so much. It's very important, though. I mean, the one thing I wanted in this book was to make sure that black folks were humanized, that people did not, you know, develop this monstrous super predator picture of black boys.
Well, or black fathers.
Or black fathers.
You know, we see other statistics that black fathers often feel if they can't do it perfectly, if they can't be the perfect breadwinner, then it's a matter of pride that they shouldn't do it at all. As someone said,
right,
the lion would rather be proud than lead his pride. And you're saying, no, you got a flaw, stay.
You got to stick with it. But I think, now you hit on the exact truth, because one of the things that my dad said in the course of interviewing for him for this book was that there were moments when he could not provide, and he came to understand what his father had done, why his father had basically stepped out. But that's not to condone it at all. We're in a different time now. You know, things have changed. What it means to be a man has changed. What it means to be a woman has changed. I think I've been with my better half for 10 years now. We have a 7-year-old son. I think I spent maybe, it's been probably, because I'm a writer, you know, that was probably 1 year when I made more money than her. That was it. I mean, we have to find new ways of defining ourselves as men. And this is race aside, you know, besides that. And I think, you know, spending time with your children, raising your children, you know, there's nothing more macho than that. Don't get much better.
By the way, you dedicate your book to your mom. Credit your dad with giving you Greg Tate's Flyboy and the Buttermilk,
which changed
your life. Just can you tell us briefly why?
Because it made me aware that somewhere in the world there were people who sat around and thought, what is the meaning of Chuck D? And then went and wrote about it, and that they actually lived doing that. Now, things that I just thought about on the regular, with people who did that, and that was their career, that was their life's work. That was amazing to me.
Well, you can now add to Greg Tate's Flyboy in the Buttermilk, Ta-Nehisi Coates' new memoir, The Beautiful Struggle, A Father, Two Sons, and an Unlikely Road to Manhood, for inspiration. Ta-Nehisi, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Rob.
All right. A quick note about some of the stories in the works at Here and Now. With gas at the $4 a gallon mark and climbing sometimes by the hour, it seems, how do you cut back? Well, sometimes it's not more fuel efficient to open the windows rather than use the AC, for instance. We'll have other thoughts. Also, what might healthcare look like under a President McCain or a President Obama? And sounds of summer, Usher, Coldplay, Lil Wayne, Al Green, even hear a little more of Rakim in the days ahead. Still ahead today, sounds of Broadway as we head to the Tony Awards, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Why is U.S. beef causing such an uproar in South Korea? 80,000 South Koreans took to the streets of Seoul yesterday, the largest demonstration in 6 weeks of protests that have included Buddhist monks and high school students holding signs reading, "I am too young to die of mad cow disease." The protesters are demanding that new pro-American conservative president Lee Myung-pak, a former Hyundai executive known as the Bulldozer, reverse his recent decision to resume imports of U.S. beef, which had been banned after the first case of mad cow was confirmed in the U.S. 5 years ago. But as we'll hear, there's much more to the story. We start with Sean Carberry, a producer for the public radio program America Abroad. He happened to be in Seoul when the protest occurred yesterday. Sean, these pictures are astonishing of the people in the streets all holding candles last night. What are the streets like now?
The streets now actually look pretty much back to normal. In fact, it was surprising how clean they were this afternoon as I was walking around downtown in the area where the protests were last night.
So thousands came out and then seemed to as quickly disappear, but do you know how they got to the streets? I mean, what did people say to you?
People I talked to were generally coming out. The beef was the core issue, but it turned into this anger against the president, people feeling like he's not governing as a president, he's governing as a CEO. And one man I spoke to, I walked up to him and asked him why he was out last night, and he just said, "I'm here to be against the president." And he paused and then said, "I hate him." This is the level of anger towards the president that was out on the streets last night.
Could you tell, just in walking in the crowds, how much of it was fueled by the internet? And what we hear was pretty sensational media as well.
Well, there's certainly a viral quality to what was going on last night. I mean, this did start as several weeks of protests about the beef issue. It became more personal about his leadership. And then it certainly turned into an event. I mean, there's no question that there was a feel last night that this was something to attend, like almost New Year's Eve or a Lollapalooza without all the tattoos.
That's producer Sean Carberry from Seoul, South Korea, in the country for the public radio program America Abroad. To see Sean's pictures, go to our website, here-now.org. Well, Bruce Klingner is a Korea specialist at the Heritage Foundation in Washington. Let's get his view. Bruce, we understand this started with students several weeks ago, but spread quickly to other issues. You don't think the protesters are finished, but why would there be such hatred of President Lee?
Well, there's a lot of underlying factors. The beef decision to reopen the market to U.S. beef was the trigger, but there really was already a bit of a tinderbox. And the protests quickly evolved to anti-U.S. and then anti-President Lee. People are reacting against some of his cabinet choices who had to withdraw over corruption allegations. He had some policy missteps early on, and they feel he's not listening to the common people. He's not. He's just dictating to them and treating them like employees of a company rather than the voters.
President Lee is also said to be the opposite of his predecessor when it comes to North Korea. The previous administration had hoped in embracing North Korea they might convince the country to abandon a nuclear weapons program. He's said to be tougher. But who are the people who are out protesting? And no pun intended, but what is their beef?
Right. Well, there's a consortium of 1,700 groups that are protesting, but really you can divide them into three main groups. One is the people, including housewives and regular citizens, who are sincerely, if misguidedly, concerned about the safety of U.S. beef.
We want to ask about that because world organizations have cleared U.S. beef for safety. Other countries, Japan, lifted their bans. But we understand there's very sensational media about this in South Korea.
Right. There have been some TV shows that had inaccurate descriptions. They were forced to retract some of their reports. There have been a lot of internet-driven mischaracterizations about the safety of U.S. beef. And it's likely that most South Koreans don't realize that U.S. beef has higher safety standards than South Korean beef right now. The OIE, the International Health Organization, has the U.S. listed as a controlled risk country, whereas South Korea remains an undetermined risk because they haven't even provided the material to be considered at the same level as the U.S. And conceivably, there may have been mad cow disease in South Korea, but the lax monitoring procedures would have prevented detection.
Well, and there are other groups as well, and we know that the beef issue is part of a broader issue of a trade deal between South Korea and Washington. So who are these other groups?
Well, the sort of the second main group is those who are against the U.S. For a variety of reasons. And there's just sort of this latent anti-Americanism in South Korea. There's always a sense that the large U.S. is dictating to the smaller South Korea what they have to do. And that's based on sort of decades of perceptions.
But what is the protest against the trade deal?
Almost a year ago, the U.S. and South Korea signed a free trade agreement which would lower tariffs on both sides, and overall both countries would benefit. But South Korea is fearful of globalization. They are a very closed society in that sense. I mean, there's a lot of free trade, but there are this residual protectionism and a fear that as a small country they're going to be eaten up by the U.S. competitors.
Well, there are workers in the U.S. afraid of that as well, auto workers, watching a flood of cars from Asia coming to the U.S. They want South Korea to take in more American cars, and Democrats like Barack Obama are siding with them against the trade deal, which, by the way, you're in favor of. And everyone, it seems, is trying to leverage the beef talks, which are not technically a part of the overall trade deal. U.S. cattle workers want the beef ban lifted because South Korea is big business for them. But South Koreans' farmers are fearful of losing their market in their country.
Right, but the South Korean government has already pledged over $1 billion in support for the South Korean agricultural market, especially the beef farmers, to compensate them for the increased competition. And the thing is, right now, South Korean beef would be about four times as expensive as U.S. beef. So it would benefit the consumers in South Korea to have the market open and allow them to make the decision on what beef to get.
Well, what do you think endgame is here for President Yi? His cabinet has offered to resign. What do you think is going to happen to his administration?
Well, he's going to have to, I think, step up his game a bit if he wants to resolve the situation. The danger is that the protests continue. With President Bush visiting South Korea in July, it may shift back to a stronger anti-U.S. focus. If he revises his apparently authoritarian tone and eliminates some of the more contentious cabinet officers, that could reduce the protests, at least of that first group, the ones who are legitimately concerned about health concerns. And also there's starting to be perhaps the first inklings of a shift in mood, in that some of the general public are becoming disenfranchised by the violence of these protests. So South Korean public may start being fearful of the impact it has on their pocketbook.
Bruce Klingner, Senior Research Fellow focusing on Korea at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C. Bruce, thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Let me just take a second to remind you, if you've missed anything on the program, you can always download a podcast. Take us with you wherever you go. Just go to our website, here-now.org. And don't forget, before we go today, a taste of the Tonys, two Broadway revivals, beautiful music coming up. You're listening to Here and Now. Author Edith Wharton was born into old New York aristocracy. In fact, her mother was a Jones, as in keeping up with the Joneses. But Edith found that life suffocating. She fled to Europe and then built a palatial estate in Lenox, Massachusetts, to escape the overstuffed drawing rooms of Manhattan. Now that retreat, The Mount, where Wharton wrote the classic The House of Mirth, is under threat of foreclosure. After years of trying different fundraisers, the trust that runs The Mount can't make the mortgage payments. Well, joining us to talk about The Mount and its place in American architectural and decorative history is Dominique Browning. She's former editor-in-chief of House and Garden magazine. Dominique, start by describing The Mount.
It's a beautiful house in the New England estate style. It's white with green shutters, and it's a mix of different styles. The courtyard is in the French tradition. There's a large, sprawling Italianate terrace right at the front of the house, and the building itself was modeled on an English estate by Christopher Wren. So you can see it's brought together many different cultures in New England.
Well, what did design mean to Edith Wharton? Because, well, we know she wrote a book on home decor. It's called The Decoration of Houses. And references to decor are so much a part of her writing. Why?
She was obsessed with design, I would say, and not only decoration and architecture, but as well gardens. They play a very important part of her novels. The settings are always part of the drama that's going on, but they're also metaphorically rich and important. The way a person lives has a lot to do with the way they think and a lot to do with their character in Edith Wharton novels.
I wonder if there was something else going on as well, if the house maybe represented a certain freedom for her. She was the first woman to win a Pulitzer Prize, but really chafed at the way women were treated in her era.
You know, she really did have to fight not only in a feminist sense, but the idea of women of her class being independent. And the house, the Mount, does represent financial freedom for her because it was built with funds partly inherited from her mother, but also from the first successful sales of her short stories and her novels.
The house had a library, and it actually had books, which was important to her. Libraries in the day often didn't. No heavy draperies. She wanted it light. What were some of the ideas that she implemented in the Mount that stayed with architecture and design?
The fundamental idea there was that architecture and interior design needed to be connected. So, for example, in today's world, she would be aghast at the idea of mid-century furniture in a farmhouse in a country setting.
Well, in a funny way, she's become almost, in that way, would be almost as rigid as the family she fled.
That's right, exactly. She was reacting very strongly against the Victorian households in which she had grown up and socialized that were full of overstep upholstery and floral wallpaper and very massive, heavy velour and silk draperies. And she was advocating a kind of a simplicity of decorating that is really very appealing today. She wrote in bed in the mornings, so she thought a lot about her bedroom. And it had very simple white walls, an oak floor. It was lit by wall sconces. And she went to a lot of trouble thinking about where her bedroom would be and what part of the garden it would look down on.
Well, the Mount was built in 1901. As we said, she lived there for 10 years, died in France in 1937. And since then, the house was home to a girls' school, to a Shakespeare company recently. Then it was fully renovated, used for tours. Now it's in danger of foreclosure. What kind of a loss would it be if it were suddenly the Mount, guest cottages and overnight stays, or the Mount condominium sales, you know?
Tragic. It is really beyond the thinkable that this country, with the wealth in the exact classes in which Edith Wharton wrote about, cannot find the funds to support the house of one of our most important writers. It's inconceivable to me.
Dominique Browning, she was editor-in-chief of House and Garden magazine and is now working on her third book. It's a memoir of reaching midlife. It's called The Shadows Come Into Play. Dominique, thanks.
Thank you.
Well, just ahead, just a little bit of Broadway. Back in a minute, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Boy, it could be a tough choice Sunday night. Rodgers and Hammerstein or Celtics-Lakers? I might have to go with South Pacific, one of the Broadway offerings up for Tony Award this Sunday when CBS broadcasts those ceremonies. Of course, the Tonys are never as big as Emmys or Oscars. But Here Now critic-at-large Ed Siegel says two revivals, including South Pacific and Carol Churchill's Top Girls, say as much about the state we're in as anything he's seen on TV or at the movies lately, and that's saying something. Ed, welcome.
Hello, Robin.
And so you have to go all the way back to the Paleozoic era, to South Pacific, to learn about today. I mean, tell us more about that.
Timelessness is a hallmark of all significant art. And English playwright Carol Churchill's Top Girls actually comes out of a very specific time and place, the 80s of Margaret Thatcher. And all through it, I couldn't stop thinking about another prominent woman who had been up for election this year, Hillary Clinton.
Well, now we're curious. Tell us more about that, because it's not your typical political play.
That's right. This one is three acts, and it begins with a surrealistic dinner party hosted by Marlene. She's a woman who's celebrating her promotion at the Top Girls Employment Agency. And she's invited some extraordinary women from across the centuries, including Pope Joan from the 9th century, a woman who disguised herself as a man and eventually made it all the way up to Pope. Now, I should say that historians don't really think there's much truth to that story, but it makes for a great character.
And a great play, and a great dinner party in this play.
That's right. Here's some of Churchill's initially confusing, but it's ultimately very funny, overlapping dialogue with Elizabeth Marvel as Marlene.
Again, she's the woman who's celebrating her promotion at
That's
Top
right.
Girls, right?
That's right. And Martha Plimpton is Pope Joan, and Marissa Tomei is Isabella Bird, a 19th century world traveler.
It could happen.
I'm sure it's just the beginning of something extraordinary.
Well, it's worth a party.
You, Marlene!
Marlene!
And all of us!
Marlene!
We have all come a long way to our courage and the way we have changed our lives and our extraordinary achievements.
So I think what Churchill is asking in this play is, how do women carry themselves? In the more naturalistic second and third acts, Marlene's niece Angie arrives at her doorstep. Marlene is a real Darwinian. She thinks that she's made it, and so can anybody else. But Churchill is no fan of Thatcher's.
Carol Churchill, the playwright who's written this, yep.
That's right. She's no fan of Margaret Thatcher's. And she's asking, I think, at what cost does success come to Marlene and to Thatcher? And do you have to become a man to make it as a woman, whatever that means, adopting the most macho of poses? I thought of Hillary saying, we could obliterate Iran if we had to.
Right.
Here's another member of the fine cast, Mary Beth Hurd. She's interviewing at the employment agency, and here's kind of what I mean.
I've spent 20 years in middle management. I've seen young men who I've trained go on in my own company or elsewhere to higher things. Nobody notices me. I don't expect it. I don't attract attention by making mistakes. Everybody takes it for granted that my work is perfect. They will notice me when I am gone. They will see when I am gone what I was doing for them.
Oh, for Hillary Clinton supporters, that resonates as well there.
Absolutely.
All right, do we have the tissues? I think we can begin to speak of your second selection. Let's listen.
Bali ha.
I just...
Absolutely.
Valley, you know, high.
When the production begins, I mean, everybody in the audience, including me, is reaching for the Kleenex.
How? Why? Why does South Pacific have such a hold on it?
Well, for one thing, I think every Rodgers and Hammerstein song here, it's not only a great tune, but it advances the story and it captures the emotional growth of each of the characters. It's almost like musical theater's answer to Sgt. Pepper. And they give a lot of room for Christopher Gattelli's great choreography as that intimate opening scene between Nellie Forbush and Emile Debeck ends, the supporting cast storms onto the South Pacific coast.
Well, would you just briefly remind us what this is about, Nellie? Who's Nellie and
okay. Who's
Emile?
Nellie has joined the Navy from Kansas, and she's on the South Pacific Island where she falls in love with a plantation owner, Emile Debeck.
Kelly O'Hara plays Nellie Forbush. She got her start in Light in the Piazza, but boy, she has catapulted. Critics are saying she's single-handedly brought back the role of the ingenue.
She made me forget all about Mary Martin. She is some Nellie. She doesn't overpower any of these songs, but listen to all the personality she puts into her realization that she's fallen in love, and you'll have to imagine her doing the cartwheeling around the stage here.
I feel I'm as corny as Kansas in August. I'm as normal as blueberry pie. No more a smart little girl with no heart. I have found me.
Well, and Nellie's counterpart is played by the Brazilian-born opera star Paulo Schott. He plays Emile.
Right, and let's let his voice sing for itself.
Now,
now I'm alone, still dreaming of paradise, still saying that paradise was nearly was mine.
There's a history of big voices in this part, which also makes you feel kind of that old world feeling. So why? Tell us more about why it resonates so now.
There's something incredibly moving about the way Nellie matures from naive, cockeyed optimist to that sensitive, mature woman. That's common to almost all the musicals of the 50s and 60s. But I was even more struck here by the racial aspects of the story. In that Bloody Mary is the Girl I Love number, the blacks in the Navy are in the background on stage, as of course they were in the segregated armed forces of World War II. And this production restores Nellie's reaction to learning that Emile has Polynesian children with the previous wife, whom Nellie calls colored in here. Mm. That was deleted in the original. Mm. So she, like the rest of the country, has moved from racism to maybe something approaching colorblindness.
Oh dear, another presidential candidate. Enters the picture? I mean, is there something resonating
there? Yeah, I think whether he wins or not, the fact that a person of color has been nominated by one of the two major parties has to be enormously resonant with a Broadway audience. But put all that aside, if you want somebody to know what's so great about theater, particularly musical theater, well, I feel a song cue coming on. This is really some enchanted evening.
Some enchanted evening. You may see a stranger, you may see a stranger across a crowded
room. Do we have to do something here? South Pacific has an open-ended run at Lincoln Center's Vivian Beaumont Theater. We also spoke of the Manhattan Theater Club revival of Top Girls. It continues at the Biltmore Theater through June 29th. And, of course, the Tonys, and we can only hope they'll sing some of these numbers Sunday night, the Tony Awards ceremony this Sunday night. Ed Siegel, critic at large for Here and Now. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Once you have found her,
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.